my heart.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KUCI FM in Irvine.
Radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And we're available via podcast, either through iTunes or at Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left-hand side of your screen, which will lead you to our radio page. And from there, you can view past guests, upcoming interviews, and access our archives to our past shows. There are nearly 200 interviews up and available to you now, so be sure to check them out. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Barbara will be back with you next week. Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, we bring you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, publishers, all those folks responsible for putting books out into the world, onto our shelves, and into our lives. And this morning, I'm joined by the wonderful Andrea Barrett, and in the second half hour, Claire Davis will be here, so please stay with me for that. Andrea Barrett is the author of 6 novels and 2 short story collections. She's received the National Book Award for Fiction for Ship Fever in 1996 and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Servants of the Map in 2002. She teaches at Williams College and in the MFA program for writers at the Warren Wilson College. Awarded a MacArthur Fellowship in 2001, she was also a fellow at the Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. It is her latest book, The Air We Breathe, published by Norton and available in bookstores now, that is the primary subject of our discussion this morning. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here. Before we get into the new book, I want to spend some time talking about the short story form versus the novel form, because they're such different animals, and you've done both so eloquently. Does an idea present itself to you obviously as a novel or as a short story? How long do you work with it before you know its form and what nature it's going to take?
It really depends on the particular piece. Quite often, I know as soon as I start what it is. It says to me, "Oh, this is a long story," or "This is a short story," or "This is a novel." But I'm sometimes just spectacularly wrong. I started The Voyage of the Narwhal thinking it was somewhere between a long story and a novella. I actually meant it as a companion for Ship Fever, and within 5 or 6 pages, I realized, oh no, novel. And I have also written very long stories, 100 pages plus, thinking they were going to turn into novels, and realized, no, they're actually a 30 or 40 page story, and trimmed them all the way back. I can't always tell, and I think that's because my short stories are not structured like most people's short stories, in the sense that the traditional short story is got one or at most a few central characters, takes place over a relatively small amount of time, often follows only one arc of action. And I tend to write stories that include a lot of people and sometimes take place over decades, sometimes in several locations. They're more like compressed novels than they are like normal short stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering if there's a different structure to your thinking or your approach that you take with each form. I mean, it sounds like, you know, in some cases you have to get quite a ways into it before you know what it is. But does your thinking about it take on sort of different elements when you know you're dealing with a novel versus a short story?
It does, in the sense that obviously one has more room in the novel. In my case, that doesn't mean necessarily that I'm going to include more characters or more time. What it does mean is that the texture and the rhythm is going to be very different. In a novel, I can do a lot more things in full scene, have a lot more conversation, linger longer on specific moments. My stories tend to be more compressed. There tends to be more summary or scenic summary, and not to open out very often into full scene. You can if you're going to cover half a century and 40 pages.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell us about The Air We Breathe, perhaps a brief introduction to the subject matter of the book and how it came to be.
Sure. The novel's set in 1916 and 1917 in a public sanatorium in the northern Adirondacks of New York State. Takes place over the course of about 18 months. I got interested in the subject originally during the writing of The Cure, which is the very long story that concludes Servants of the Map. And that is actually about people in private cure cottages in that same area during the 1880s and 1890s. So I was thinking then about people who had this terrible disease and had to leave their homes and go to the mountains. But they were staying in houses with 8 or 10 other people, in conditions of some comfort, if not luxury. They're sort of like little inns. But I got really interested then in these great big forbidding public sanatoria out in the woods, usually some miles from the villages, and usually populated by people from large urban areas, primarily New York City, often immigrants, always with no money because they were essentially charity institutions. They were supported by the taxpayers. Since people have been dismissed from the sanatoria after the introduction of an effective drug in the 1940s, a lot of those buildings have been turned into prisons or psychiatric wards, sometimes into nursing homes. And there's a reason for that. The architecture has the feel almost of a prison. They're very forbidding-looking institutions, and I got really interested about what it would be like to be confined to one.
Amazing. I know that you were heavily influenced by the events on September 11th and in fact moved to New York for the fellowship on September 10th, 2001. And I was talking with Catherine Weber, who wrote a wonderful novel on the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire post 9/11.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how literature written post 9/11 is... That's always in the backdrop, and it becomes a context for how literature goes forward after that event. And I hoped you could spend a few minutes talking about the influences of September 11th on this novel and on your thinking about writing in general.
Sure. I actually had gone to... The fellowship didn't start till September 10th, but I had moved to Brooklyn from Rochester, New York, in June of that year. One of the characters in this book works in a sugar refinery in Brooklyn, and I actually moved quite close to that, into the same neighborhood. I'm not a New Yorker, and I had never lived in New York, and I wanted to see the buildings and sort of get the feel of the area and walk around this factory. I had no intention when I moved there of writing a novel that would concern itself so much with the war or with the effect of the war on politics. I really thought I was writing a novel solely about a group of people confined in the sanatorium. In the aftermath of September 11th, and especially in the aftermath of our entry into the war, really everything changed about the novel, as everything changed for all of us. I started to think a lot more about what happens when a country feels in danger, under threat of attack, how easy it is for us to feel threatened, and in feeling threatened to stigmatize someone else as other or separate, to push groups outside, and that all influenced the structure of the novel very much. The patients are not in the ward directly, and they're not under threat directly, but their whole way of life is completely changed by what's going on politically around them, as everyone's way of life was changed, not so much precisely by September 11th and its aftermath, but by the conversations that went on subsequent to that, and by the war, and by the conversations about the war. So I can't imagine really writing a novel in the years after September 11th without it being influenced, even if the subject matter looks utterly different. I think all of us were shaped by that. Many people didn't write for a while, and I was one of them. I did a lot of reading and research after September 11th, but I didn't write for more than a year after that. It just didn't, it's so common as to be trite, but it really just didn't seem to have any point for a while. I just couldn't imagine what I could write that would have any meaning, or why I would try to write. And, you know, slowly that seeps back, that sense that writing is always important, even if we are not the kind of writers that can confront these events directly in the form of nonfiction or journalism. It's not my way to write like that. I'm not good at it. I can't be of any use that way. But if our mode is fiction, as mine is, there's usually ways to think through these things by way of characters and situations, even if in my case I had to cast back to 1916 to actually talk about how I was thinking and feeling then.
And I don't want to give too much about the novel away, but there is the sense of heightened scrutiny of who you're living next to after events like this. And you know, history repeats itself, even though we feel like we've, you know, made progress and learned from mistakes. It's amazing how you know, at our core, we're human beings, and we act in similar ways in similar circumstances.
Yeah, it does feel really circular sometimes. It's during the year when I was reading intensively and unable to write, I grew quite fascinated by the analogies between the time when the novel is set and our own time. But you can pair up events in almost any time that way. We do seem to go through the same sets of feelings and the same patterns again and again. Of course we do. We're always human beings. Our context changes, but at core we're always individuals, and we're members of a community, and we're on the fringes of other communities. And when we're stressed, whether singly or in groups, we tend to act in certain ways.
Perhaps I'll have you read from the book now, and then we can go from there to discussing it. Can you read? I'll remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Andrea Barrett, author of many things, but most recently, The Air We Breathe.
I'm going to read a little section that comes early on in the novel about how one of the characters, whose name is Leo Marburg, gets sick and ends up coming to the sanatorium. Somewhere between Leo's first days on the Lower East Side and his move to Williamsburg in the sugar refinery, between the job in the char house, which he'd hated, and the one he'd made for himself as the head chemist's assistant, his lungs had rotted and all his prospects had disappeared. Working one day at the refinery, he'd walked from the room upstairs, where he'd been testing effluent from the melter, down four flights and past the hall that led to the char house, across the floor where the graders were working, and into the corner laboratory next to the dock, where the head chemist was analyzing a sample from the ship. He'd given Carl his results, said goodnight, and stepped outside. Near the door was a bin of raw sugar, the last load left to be tested. He'd leaned over to look at the color and rubbed a pinch between his fingers. Then he'd coughed, the same cough he'd had all spring, no more, and watched, astonished, as blood sprayed over the pale crystals. Everything after that had also caught him by surprise, and that itself had been surprising. Despite his 6 years in New York, despite all his jobs and the people he'd met and the evening classes leading up to his citizenship hearing, he still hadn't expected the way that once the government was involved, one step led to the next and the next, until he was cornered and forced up here. A nurse came to the flat where he'd boarded in Brooklyn. Someone who had seen what happened at the refinery had told someone else who told someone who worked at the clinic. What a fool he'd been, not to spit over the side of the dock, not to hide his cough. A mouthful of blood on a mountain of sugar, and then this.
Mm. That was Andrea Barrett reading from The Air We Breathe, published by Norton. That is one of the enduring images that stayed with me after the book was done. It's very haunting. How much of the ending was known to you from the beginning? Because it's a very intricately constructed novel, and without, again, giving too much away, I'll say only that knowing the end, it's clear that you as the author must have constructed it carefully throughout to set up the end. That being said, how much did you know, and how much did you have to go back and massage and revise?
I didn't know anything when I started, and that's not uncommon for me. I went through many, many, many revisions, largely because I had the voice of the novel early on, this strange collective first-person narrator that also has certain omniscient properties. What I didn't know was why I had the voice. It refused to be told in any other voice than it is told. I tried a number of different ways, which would have been a good deal easier, but this was the voice it wanted to be. So my question was, why? Why is the voice? Who are these people? Why are they telling this story? So it was only through many drafts and a lot of revisions that I finally got the real ending of the novel. And at a certain point, when the voice admits that it has done a certain thing and failed to do other things, I suddenly understood why the collective voice wouldn't break into individuals. And then I had to go back and rewrite everything again for the zillionth time.
Yeah, we should.
That's always the way I work, though.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a common way to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should talk more about point of view, because it was so interestingly done, and I was trying to think if I could remember a novel told this way. It had sort of a Greek chorus sort of feel, and
yeah.
So there's this collective we that's, you know, sort of first person in the background, but you do have liberty to go into private conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting that was in place early on, and how you worked with it. Was it, so it sounds like it was a combination of something natural and something sort of complicated and forging new ground.
That's a great way to think about it. It was natural in terms of, you know, hearing the voice very clearly and hearing its intonations, and it was very complicated in trying to understand what the rules of the voice were. You know, if it's a we, if they're telling the story, into whose head can it enter? How can it enter? Where is it getting the information from? How is it relaying that information? What does the group of people who are narrating it know and not know? What can they be allowed to know and not know? Trying to find out the limits of their knowledge was a strange task for me and occupied me through several drafts. It didn't make sense to me for a long time, and then in that way that always happens to writers, one day I woke up and it did make sense. And I kept trying to force it into much more complicated shapes, and, you know, embedding diaries and letters and all these mechanisms through which certain information could enter the story, and at some point I realized a set of reasons that made that unnecessary and made it flow much more naturally.
I should also mention, for those who don't know, that you were a scientist by training, a biologist.
I was. That's what I meant to do.
Yeah, before taking up the craft of writing, which is so interesting to me because science, you know, strikes me as something very rigid and structured and exercises a different part of the brain than writing does.
Science is not so rigid, really. There's more in common than you'd think between scientists and writers. They're very intuitive, too, in part of their life.
Yeah. And your background in biology and in science in general entered into this novel quite a lot, as it does in a lot of your novels.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about kind of the crossover? I'm interested in how scientists are more like writers than we're willing to think about them.
Well, the best scientists are passionate and intuitive and creative, just the way that writers and artists and musicians are. The expression of their work demands a kind of linear logic and a meticulous attention to detail that we think of as being more scientific somehow than artistic, but they have nothing to express without those same leaps of logic and leaps of intuition that we have as artists. Any working scientist I've ever known will usually admit that his or her best ideas come, in a sense, out of nowhere, the same way that we recognize them. They have these intuitions. They wake with a sense of, oh, that's what that experiment means, or what if I tried this? It must mean X rather than Y. So there's a component of their lives that is very far from being under their control, just as there's a component of any writer's life that is also not under our control. We can learn as much as we can about the craft of writing. We can bring all our craft to bear on a set of material, but we don't usually get to choose our material. our material sort of chooses us, if it's real material, if it's authentic and not purely willed. And scientists often say that their best problems also choose them rather than the reverse. They can plan to work in a certain field. They can think they're going to work on a certain problem, but in the course of designing an experiment or working out a hypothesis, they very often will stumble by serendipity into something quite unexpected, and almost always that will be more interesting than what they thought they were doing, and almost always their real insights will come out of that problem. And that, to me, that seems so much like writing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, that's well put. I also want to talk about subplotting, because there are some very eloquent and interesting subplots in here. Miles is one of the main characters, and has an interest in paleontology.
Mm-hmm.
There's some wonderful background on the development of X-rays, and some scientific and political subplots. How do you, I know subplots need to run kind of in parallel with the main storyline,
right,
to reverberate just right, but to act as a counterpoint. How do you know when you've got the right subplots going, or how do you go about settling in on them?
Again, it's mostly trial and error. I wish I were a more reasonable writer, but I'm actually not. So
I don't know any of those.
Yeah, we're not so reasonable as a class, but partly I try out stuff based on my own passions and interests. I get intrigued in something, say the history of X-rays, and I'll build a character that works with those and try to weave that in. Sometimes it works over the course of many drafts, in which case, I can keep deepening it further and further with each draft and exploring the nature of the subplot material. And sometimes I'll just take a false turn. Pretty commonly I will, and then I will have to just excise that wing and try something else. Hopefully by the time I've finished, all those strands work together to form a kind of tapestry where each thread does reinforce and speak to the other threads. But when I start, it's just rubble. It's chaos and rubble.
What was the most surprising thing that emerged from, particularly from this novel for you, or I guess from writing in general, you could talk about, but maybe the most surprising thing that came out of this novel for you?
Really the most surprising thing was that strange voice. I never had meant to write anything like this, and I'm pretty comfortable in other voices and have employed, fairly standard strategies for a long time. I never had the idea, I'm going to try and invent this really strange narrative voice and see where it leads me. So I was quite surprised to find myself in this corner, given this thing that I had to make sense of. It was very humbling in a way, because it was just hard. I just couldn't get it right for a long time. And in a way, that's also really exhilarating. I've been writing for a long time now, and one of the great things about writing is no matter how long you do it, you actually never get good at it, or I don't get good at it anyway. I learn one particular story set of issues or one particular novel set of problems at a time. And over the course of years spent working on that particular book or story, I will get better at the problems of that particular story. But when I put it down and I start over, I'm a beginner again, like everyone else. It's either I start feeling of, oh, this is just too hard for me. I'm not smart enough to do this. And that's lovely. I mean, how many fields do you know where you get to be a beginner all over again every time? It's also, of course, terrifying. But
it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. And you said in an interview somewhat recently that the joy and purpose of writing for you and is in essence to allow you to make sense of the chaotic world and to put order to things that are inherently sort of disorderly. Do you think that's still true for you? Is that the joy of writing for you?
It is still. You know, maybe that's the part where I overlap into science more. Maybe that's what drew me to science in the first place, although I'm actually not very good at it. But struggling with a set of words over a long period of time, struggling with a set of images and subplots and characters and the sounds of words and sentences, all of that is a way of sort of pushing chaos into the background and making order out of what's around all of us. And for me, that's very important and very satisfying. The world is quite chaotic, or at least I perceive it that way. And I also perceive the world as being very deeply interconnected, all the layers connected all to all the other layers, everyone connected to everyone else. And writing allows me to work with both those feelings. It allows me to make order out of rubble and chaos, and it allows me to make sometimes quite elaborate structures that connect that which was not necessarily connected in my mind or sometimes in anyone else's mind before. Mm. And that's very satisfying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Any last-minute words of advice for our writerly listeners?
Persistence is really very useful. I started writing late, and I wrote badly for a really long time, and I published very late because I was writing badly for a very long time, and had I given up, I would not have had all this pleasure in making books. It's among the students I teach, it's quite often not the ones who seem most obviously gifted who make it as writers. It's the ones who are really dogged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you're far, far too humble.
Well,
if you're this hard on yourself, there's no hope for the rest of us.
Well, writers are supposed to be hard on ourselves. That's how we get better.
Well, you certainly have the corner on that. This is wonderful.
Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you so much for taking the time here.
Well, it's my pleasure, truly.
It was my pleasure, too. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll be joined by Claire Davis. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. I'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. You know, little darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
If a Middle Earth elf lived today in Southern California, how would she celebrate and support the arts, music, and her community? What would Arwen do? Thursdays with me, Tani Tenuvio, on KUCI 88.9 FM and streaming live at KUCI.org. Ellen Salalumin Amenti Alfa.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly Signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand, online at weeklysignals.com, or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals, Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI FM in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. And as I mentioned earlier, this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit penonfire.com for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, who will be back with you again next week. Claire Davis is the author of two novels, Season of the Snake and Winter Range, which received the Mountains and Plains Booksellers Award for Fiction and the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award. Her work has appeared in the Pushcart Prize Anthology and the Best American Short Stories. Claire teaches writing at Lewis Clark State College. She and fellow writer Kim Barnes recently co-edited Kiss Tomorrow, Hello, a collection of essays by women writers about the experience of aging and how each handles different aspects of entering this new stage of life. But it's Claire's latest collection of short stories, Labors of the Heart, published in paperback by Picador, that we'll be discussing this morning. The book is comprised of stories which first appeared in major literary journals and award-winning anthologies. Her stories have appeared in the Gettysburg Review, Plowshares, the Southern Review, to name a few, and have been read on NPR's Selected Shorts. Claire, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, I really enjoyed this collection. It drew me in, and I think that's due in part, well, I think it's due to several things, but one thing in particular, and that's the strangeness of it for me. And I was thinking about this concept of strangeness recently when I came upon a reference in Harold Bloom's opus on the Western canon. And he was considering the question of what makes a book great, and concluded that it all comes down to this notion of strangeness. A book always leaves a strange impression, and if it's strange, it'll remain strange no matter how many times you've read it. And I found that particularly true with this collection. It catches you off guard, and you think you can anticipate where a story is going to go, and you discover you really can't.
That issue of strangeness, the quality of strangeness, you know, and it's curious because I think even in the most ordinary people, there are those times or those events in our lives in which we encounter strangeness, or we become other than ourselves momentarily. And I think just that quality is alive in the world. I mean, mm-hmm. all about us. A new way of reckoning with things or recognizing things.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Are you, were there any particular stories in the collection where you felt that element more present than other stories? Were there stories you were more drawn into the strangeness of it, or the new ground you were forging with them?
Well, I have to say, maybe the strangest of them all for me was Stiff Soup. The story of a young boy having to eat a bowl of very stiff pea soup. And where that took me was pretty strange. But, you know, in terms of being involved in the stories or pulled in or drawn in, probably the title story, Labors of the Heart, in which you have to imagine what it means to live in a short man who's morbidly obese and sort of carry yourself through the world in his skin. I think that was probably the story that drew me in the deepest.
I guess we've already been doing this, but tell us a bit about kind of the evolution of this book, whether the stories existed. I know a lot of these stories existed independently before the book was assembled, but kind of tell us how the collection came to exist.
Well, in most short story collections, there's a lot of stories that don't end up in them. Out of maybe 20 stories, I've found these 10 that worked together well. And it was sort of an evolution of idea, I think, that held them common. It was, in some instances, letting go. It's that idea of change that comes upon you and how we adapt or how we transcend or how we transform, sometimes how we fail in the midst of it. But it was always dealing with that moment of change or that issue of change. And so the stories felt as if they were linked. Those certain stories held up as a collection.
Did all of the stories exist before the collection came about, or did you write any stories to fit in with a group?
Actually, yeah, Stiff Soup was actually the first story for a new collection I was starting on, and I ended up pulling it into this one, and Electric was new as well. Okay. So those two stories sort of rounded it out for me.
Uh-huh.
And they almost feel like it's a step into a different direction as well, which is kind of fun.
Yeah. I think if you don't mind, I'll have you read to us early on here, and then we can get into the collection itself and talk more about your craft.
Okay.
Can you read to us? I'll remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Claire Davis, author of Labors of the Heart, out in paperback and published by Picador.
I thought I'd read just a little bit from the title story, Labors of the Heart.
Perfect.
From the first couple pages. The remarkable thing in dreams, people say what he never hears in waking, fat. They say it to his face, not behind his back or clear of earshot. The word is succulent in their mouths, fat, stretching out like the waist on his Sansibel pants. Nothing derogatory about it, only an unabashed honesty. And on these mornings, for a few moments, he wakes feeling curiously relieved. Clarence John Softitch, pinky to his friends, at 5'8" and 482 pounds on a good day, is fat. Not large, big, or big-boned. Not hefty, husky, generous, or oversized. Nor robust, portly, or pleasingly plump, he is fat, enormous, corpulent, and no delicate euphemisms or polite evasions can relieve him of this knowledge. When every movement, whether tying a shoe or climbing a short flight of stairs, becomes a labor of the heart. Not that he has much to do with people in general. He lives in Clarkston, Washington, a scrappy town of 20-odd thousand on the eastern edge of the state, where the paltry rainfall encourages prickly pear and lawns and 12% of the population's on welfare. He works as night janitor at Loyola High School, and when most of the town's folks are gathered in families for dinner or socially at Hogan's Bar, Pinky's company is the clatter of scrub bucket, mop, and brush, and for solace he has his voice, a fine, clear tenor to fill the empty rooms. He sings, "When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore." Not that he knows anything about that, amore, that is. For he is virginal, a moderate embarrassment at his age, having come to terms, he believes, with the reality that no one loves a fat man. And so he's given up on love, the daydreams, the hope, the mooning about, the unsightly chase and precipitous rejections, until this Monday, that is, on one of his twice-weekly food shopping trips, when he sees her in the produce aisle of the North Side A&B grocery, a rutabaga under her nose, a peckish look about her mouth. She's little, a narrow, neatly plain body, and there is about her the solidity, the starkness of a lightning rod.
That's wonderful. That was Claire Davis reading from Labors of the Heart. I think your dogs love the story.
Oh, I don't know what's going on, but
no worries. I also wanted to talk about this notion of balance, because first of all, that's one of the names of the stories in the
right.
in the collection, and there are a lot of references to balance, either directly or indirectly, throughout the rest of the collection as well.
Right.
In some way, I feel like that's at the core of one of the central questions of what you're dealing with, certainly also in the title story, Labors of the Heart.
Oh, absolutely.
Was this a conscious theme that you were interested in working with, or sort of a more subconscious byproduct of what came out of the stories?
You know, I think it's something that I became aware of, that I was intrigued in. As Richard Hugo once said, we as poets, we write the same poem all our lives.
Hmm.
And I think we find those ideas or those issues in our lives that consume us or obsess us. And I think as I was writing these stories, I kept coming up to this idea of how do we achieve balance? How do we, like I said, cope? How do we transcend? How do we survive? How do we adapt?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Finding our way through our world with some measure of grace and balance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think so, I became more aware of it as I worked on the stories. I don't think I went to the stories with that idea, but the stories kept coming to that place. So something was certainly telling me what my story's about.
I suppose that, you know, in some level, every story has to be out of balance, or there isn't a story there, right?
Right. You need some narrative tension.
Right.
yes. And balance itself actually was written from my own experience of going through a child custody battle years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, very difficult time, and I was awarded custody of my child, you know, and when I started looking at it years later, I kept thinking about the power of that moment and how frightening it all was, and then I started thinking about writing a story about that, but I already knew my side of the story, so it seemed what I needed to discover then was the other side of the story, and the character in the story is not my ex-husband by any means.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely fictionalized, but you know, in exploring that other side of the story, you begin to get a fuller view of what life you've also lived.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting how fiction can sometimes help you that way, sort of find.
Yeah, it's interesting when you write about something that you've actually been through. I wonder what level of distance you need to be away from it in order to gain the clarity you need to write about it. How long after the event were you able to reflect back on it and feel like you could get your mind around writing about it?
It was a good 4 or 5 years afterwards.
Okay.
But it's one of those events in your life that haunt you.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, because you know the pain you're doing to each other and, you know, what's at stake.
Right.
And it just seemed like an important thing to write about. But it was a good 4 or 5 years before I felt I could actually look at that time and talk about even that setting.
Mm-hmm.
As
mm-hmm.
I said, the couple in it is not me or my husband at the time, but the heart of that issue is certainly there. You
mm-hmm.
know, the pain and the fear and the wanting not to do damage to each other, but somehow inevitably doing that.
Yeah, and being able to see the other person's point of view, I think, would take some years.
Right,
coming
it
out
does.
Of this.
It does. But the side effect of that finally too was having seen some small portion of the other side of it, my ex-husband and I became good friends thereafter.
Mm.
You know, so it was somewhat helpful in the healing process as well.
Yeah, interesting. There's such a wonderful sense of place throughout these stories. I know you live in Idaho now, and that's where I was born, and much of my family still resides. And, you know, I suppose this is true with every part of the country, every part of the world, for that matter. It has its own visceral sense of place, but you've captured the West in, you know, in a gorgeous and really generous light, and the sense of place is so central to these stories. Can you talk for a moment about place and how you go about grounding these stories so strongly to that particular part of the country?
Well, you know, I've always been in love with the world, I guess, but outside, the nature and the natural world.
Mm.
And I was born a Midwesterner. Actually, I was raised in the Midwest. But some part of me has always hearkened to the Northwest. And the first time I came through Idaho and I entered the hills and the mountains and the trees and the rivers, and there was a real sense of coming home, curiously.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I explored this place and the more I started to learn about it, the more it informed the writing and the more it informs me as well. I just feel so connected to the landscape. I don't know that I could sever the two anymore.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about the spaciousness. You know, and I think that's what Western writers have so in common, strangely enough, with the Southern writers. Southern writers are very, very place-oriented, very much into the ambience of the landscape. Their work is saturated with landscape and all the sensory input from that. And I see that pairing with the Western, even though the landscapes are so different. I think in the West and the South, both that natural world plays an enormous part in people's lives because it's just so, in many respects, generous itself.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because as I was reading your short stories, I was also thinking of Ron Rash and Jim Tomlinson, who write in the Appalachian part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But it did have, even though they are entirely different places, it did have that visceral, you know, sense of place. But I was wondering if that's almost a feeling of the openness and the space you have there. You talk about the silence of being in large spaces and you know, maybe the contemplative thinking that comes from being in wide open spaces where you feel very much alone. And I think Idaho and the South have that in common.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's so much open room you can lose yourself in, and I'm also a horsewoman. You know, I take my horse into the mountains quite a bit. And journeying out there by yourself, you know, into that space, into the emptiness, it's quite different than, say, living as I did in the Midwest in Milwaukee or Chicago, and, you know, being surrounded by people and buildings and closed in and sort of becoming consumed with the self. I think living in the West and putting yourself out into those large spaces, you begin to understand your place in that larger world.
Yeah, that's well put. Mm. I'm also interested in the names of your characters, particularly within this collection. These characters often had such rich and unusual names. And how do you go about selecting character names, and how do you know when you've stumbled across the right one for a character?
Oh, you know, sometimes when you find the name, the character arises out of it. That happens quite frequently for me. Other times, you know, the characters, I can't start writing until I find the characters' names. Isn't that curious? Because there's something about their personality invested in the name for me.
Yeah.
And finding them, sometimes I hear them, sometimes I see them. And truth, this is going to sound awful, but, you know, I mean, I love the old cemeteries, and some of the pairings of names are so beautiful.
Yeah. No.
Clarence Softage, I think, came from, like, Eugene, Oregon or something like that, the cemetery there. I saw Clarence Softage, and I went, oh, that's such a beautiful name. It was soft and lovely and round, and it just seemed right for Pinky.
Yeah. Actually, that's a good idea, because if you're setting stories in the past, mm-hmm. Cemeteries are fertile ground, is there?
Yeah, well, they are. Well, and just, you know, conversations, and names come to you in conversations. Sometimes the older names have that sort of resonance to them.
Right.
That some of the contemporary names always have.
That's great. I'm also interested in the order and placement of stories in a collection. I know that they aren't haphazardly just dumped into whatever order they appear on your computer screen. They, you know, need to be in dialogue with each other. Was assembling the collection itself and how you placed the stories and juxtaposed them, was that a difficult process, or how did you go about doing it?
That was really tough, and getting the distance for it. I have to admit that my editor, George Whitty at St. Martin's Press, was instrumental in it. He moved some of the pieces around, and it just made all the difference in the world for me. You need to find that rise of humor against the poignant. You know, you also have to have sort of that sense of these two stories belong together, but you don't want anything too close to each other. I mean, it's a hard balance, and getting the distance to achieve that is tough sometimes.
Yeah.
And my editor was just quite wonderful at that.
Mm. What was the most problematic aspect of the collection for you? Was there one story or one character that that gave you more problems than the others?
You know, I can't really say that. The short stories are such a delight to write. They're just these little gems, you know, and you're in the middle of, say, writing a novel, and it goes for years. You know, you're writing 2 years or a year on this novel, and it's never ending. So, and you get to sit down and write a short story, and you can do it in a month or two, you know. And, you know, some of the stories haunt me more than others. Some of them have really particularly fond memories of, like, Mouse Rampant, the taxidermy story, living in the Northwest. I had to write about taxidermy.
That was my favorite. I love that.
Did you love that? And I had to, you know, I had to do quite a bit of research, and in researching it, I realized, you know, I could do this.
You could be a taxidermist?
Well, I just thought I'd try it, and I actually did try it.
Wow.
With a little mouse. My friend was feeding snakes at the University of Montana, and she brought me 6 frozen mice.
Great.
And one evening after work, I went home, and my husband was out ice fishing at the time, my second husband, and I was doing the taxidermy on the mice when he came home, and he had no idea, and he walked into the door, and he was just appalled. And he looked at me and said, "What in God's name are you doing?" And I knew at that point that the story was not about the taxidermist, but rather about the husband.
Uh-huh.
His wife suddenly takes up taxidermy, so... I still have Mouse Rampant, actually. One little mouse that managed to come out of that slaughter a lot pretty well. He's he's mounted in a rampant pose, and he's quite cute.
Oh, great.
But, yeah, so that story, you know, little stories like that sort of move you in different ways in the world and give you different experiences.
I had actually a similar experience. I woke up on a Saturday morning, and I was in high school, and my mom had a raccoon spread all over the dining room table. And... said, "My God!" I had the exact same reaction. "My God, what are you doing?
For months afterwards, I had fellow graduate students, this was in graduate school yet, bringing me roadkill. And I was like, "No, stop. I'm not going to do this. This was just for a story."
You wake up and see somebody in a totally different light after that.
We do, yes.
That's fabulous. How does a short story, I know they start in all different ways, but do they come to you in images or in characters typically, or is it just completely particular to the story?
Yeah, it always comes to me through character. And for me, short stories, I mean, the short story is about character movement creates the plot, so if I find my character and the voice for the narrator or the voice of that character, somehow I have the story. Sometimes they come from that, you know, like the taxidermy story, truthfully, came from a time when I was at the Locksaw Lodge on the Montana-Idaho border, and this woman was dust-busting an elk. And, you know, you see that moment when she's up on the ladder with a dustbuster and going over this elk mount, you know, and I laughed so hard. It was just like, there's a story there, you know. That attentive love, you know, I had to write it. So sometimes it comes from an idea, but the idea can't take shape until the character comes around to take it in hand.
Right, right. And short stories typically are so character-driven.
So character-driven, yeah. And I know I'm a real fan of Flannery O'Connor as well, and she used to, of course, take a character and saddle it with one of the 7 deadly sins and see what happens then.
Oh, that's
always a fun device.
Great advice.
To try.
Yeah, that's a great device.
Yeah, but it's not always the sins. Like, you take a character and you saddle him with something else, like 480 pounds of flesh. What does
right.
that do to a person, right? So
right.
It's that kind of little triggers that get the story going.
Yeah. There's been this this very sad notion, because I'm such a huge fan of the short story genre, but just kind of the short story playing... I guess literature in general is playing second fiddle to MTV, but the short story kind of playing second fiddle to the novel. Do you feel that, or do you feel compelled to write novels because that's what the marketplace demands, or do you feel that kind of tug against the short story? Or,
you know, I'm really fortunate, as much as I also love writing the novel. I mean, I love writing novels, and so it's sort of a shared love for the two. So I'm going to write short stories no matter what the market says. I mean, it would be nice if people bought short stories and they became bestsellers. You know, that would be lovely.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an American art form, and it makes so much sense in our lifestyle
mm-hmm.
and the way we live today. And there's so many amazing collections out there.
Mm-hmm.
In one hand, I'm thinking, yeah, they don't bring in the kind of attention they probably should or the money they should. But I also think that there's been a resurgence in printing of short story collections. There's quite a few out there.
It does seem like there is, yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's more interest in them. You know, I think it's always been the novels, always, you know, that's what makes your career.
Right, right.
And like I said, I'm just fortunate in as much as I'm able to practice both arts and enjoy them both equally, whether they, you know, make it big or not, I don't really care.
Yeah, well, this was a marvelous collection. Any last minute words for our writers out there?
Oh, just write on. Just keep writing. Just write. Don't let the world get in the way too much. That's probably the hardest part of writing, is just not letting all the other distractions get in the way.
The hardest part, but the most true. Yeah.
Yes.
Wonderful. Claire, thanks for taking the time this morning.
Well, thank you for the interview. It's been delightful.
Me too. Mm-hmm. That was Claire Davis, author of Labors of the Heart, available in bookstores now and published by Picador. Poppy Bright gave her words of wisdom as well. If you find yourself imitating another writer, that doesn't have to be a bad thing, especially if you're a young or a new writer. However, you should be conscious of exactly how you are imitating him: word choice, sentence structure, motifs, and think about why you're doing it. With that said, when you're checking out Claire Davis's Labors of the Heart, you really should pay particular attention to her verb choice. She has some incredible verbs. Barbara DeMarco Barrett will be back with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks for joining me. Have a great day.